Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm looking at a video from a channel called Pioneer Health and Missions. This presentation is by one Thomas Aikens, who has decided to go through the Bible and see what scientific predictions it makes with regards to the flood model. He starts the presentation by just reading a bunch of Bible verses to support some of the observations that he says lead to these predictions, and rather than let him ramble through the whole thing, I'll just summarize it here. The observations are that the fountains of the Great Deep are broken open, water covered the whole earth, all the land creatures died, and it lasted a year. None of these are groundbreaking or surprising in any way, but let's see where they take us.
With all of these observations, I'm going to make the following predictions. And then we're going to look at the evidence we have in this world and see what it testifies.
That's actually not an entirely bad methodology. That's how I approach the Bible. I read it to see what observations I can make about the text, and then make predictions about how the real world should operate based on the observations that I've made about the biblical text, and then see whether or not these predictions hold up when put to the test. Unfortunately for the Bible, it has a pretty poor track record in this regard, but let's see if this guy can find a way to improve its performance.
Our first prediction is we would expect there to be what? Global erosion.
Okay, not sure how you got that specifically from any of those biblical observations that we made, but seeing as how erosion is a process that happens everywhere, global erosion is just a thing that we would expect to see in general, whether the Bible is true or not. Because, you know, wind, water, weathering chemicals, and other stuff exists.
Whenever there's a flood, there is erosion.
Yes, but more than that, it is a specific pattern of erosion and deposition. And while this pattern can be seen all over the globe, it is not universal in the sense that they correlate with the same event.
Now, this was not a local flood. This was a worldwide global flood. We should expect there to be global, that is, worldwide erosion.
Oh, I think you're going to bring up the Great Unconformity for this one. Okay, well, there's a lot that we still don't know about the Great Unconformity, but it looks like it was probably caused by a near-global tectonic uplift that occurred when the supercontinent Rodinia broke up. Evidence for this is found with a relatively new dating method, thermochronology. Thermochronology is when a geologist takes samples that contain zircon crystals and checks the ratio of radioactive elements that result in helium production with the amount of helium stuck in the crystal lattice of the zircon. Helium escapes from a zircon crystal when the crystal is heated, so by using this method, they can calculate how long it would have taken for the amount of helium they find to have accumulated since the crystal cooled enough to trap it. The temperatures where helium begins to be trapped are generally found about 6 to 8 kilometers below the surface of the Earth, so in order for rock in the Great Unconformity to have been on the surface, about 6 to 8 kilometers of rock above them must have been eroded away. Hypothetically, this helium clock could reset if a hot fluid were to flow through the rock at some point, but they have found a pretty well universal signal that matches with the Great Unconformity with this method, and a fluid flow would be expected to be localized. And while less drastic, the team also detected an uplift pulse that matches with the time when Pangaea was breaking up, so this does confirm that uplift is expected to go along with a supercontinent breaking up. This may also help explain what triggered the Snowball Earth, which was a massive period of glaciation that began about 720 million years ago. The chemical weathering associated with these levels of erosion would have resulted in the sequestering of massive amounts of carbon dioxide in the oceans and lithosphere, leading to global cooling.
Everywhere. On every continent, every island.
Well, it's not entirely global. There are locations that don't see a Great Unconformity, plenty of them in fact, but it is remarkable in its scale. Of course, you're presenting it as though it were truly global because you want it to be the result of a global flood. Well, sorry, but no dice. In fact, even in areas that do contain a great unconformity, it's not always perfectly aligned. The process of continental uplift was not universal. It would have happened slightly differently at slightly different times in different locations. And by slightly here, I mean slightly on a geologic timescale. The various unconformities that roughly match up with the great unconformity that are found all over the world seem to be dated to anywhere between a billion and 720 million years ago, so over a time span of about 280 million years. The point is, they don't all line up chronologically, and so the Great Unconformity, even if it were found globally, would still not really be a global event because it happened in different times in different places.
We would expect Earth's crust, the fountains of the Great Deep, were broken open, so we should expect to find that the crust of the Earth, the surface of the Earth, would be cracked in multiple places, globally, not just in one location, but globally.
And I assume here that you're talking about the continental rifts? To oversimplify, as the continents move away from each other, the lithosphere thins at the separation point, drawing up hot rock from the mantle. This is a very slow process. In fact, it was discovered in 2016 that during a supercontinent breakup, the continents can move away from each other at a rate much faster than normal, up to 60 millimeters per year in some cases. That's about 2.3 inches for you Yanks. Now, with the shortest distance between North America and Europe being about 7,900 kilometers, that would only take 131 million years to travel. Wow, so fast. Well, to be fair, that's actually the speed of the fastest of the rifts, which was the South Atlantic Rift. Most of the others didn't make it up past 40 millimeters per year. So, being a creationist, you'll want the continents to have done the majority of their traveling over the one-year flood period, right? Well, you're gonna have to provide a lot of evidence to support that. Probably the best piece of evidence you could bring to the table is that the Earth is, in fact, still a molten ball today as a direct result of the increase in temperature that would result from such a rapid continental drift. And this is based on Dr. John Baumgartner's calculations that were published in the Creation Research Society Quarterly's journal. In order for the rocks to have cooled to what we see today, they would have had to have cooled 10 to the 4th times faster than they are observed to cool, and that was ignoring the significant warming effects of nuclear decay. So, based on a creationist's very conservative calculations, it is impossible for the continents to have rearranged themselves from Pangaea to what we see today over 1 year, just 4,000 years ago, without having to appeal to magic. Of course, he doesn't say magic in the paper, he calls it non-stationary natural laws, but it is indistinguishable from magic.
Thirdly, we would expect to find global sedimentary layering.
First off, no, we wouldn't. You wouldn't see the variety of strata that exists. It would be one large layer of conglomerate, not millions of small layers. Secondly, even if strata were expected, since this is a global event, we would expect the strata to match nearly perfectly all over the planet. This is not what we see, though. We see different types of layers formed based on the conditions of their local environments. That popular creationist talking point about how the geologic column is not found in any one place? That's the expectation if the flood did not happen, because we don't see global depositional environments. In the creationist flood model, though, the vast majority of deposition happened in one global depositional event, so they should match up pretty well with only minor variations from place to place. But no, we have to do things like find volcanic eruptions to correlate the strata from place to place because the local environments aren't the same all over the Earth. In fact, we can trace strata laterally and see environmental change. If we follow the strata, we can sometimes see it transition from deep marine to shallow marine to beach and other similar transitions. Tell me, how did a beach exist under 15 cubits of water?
Why? Because it tells us this event lasted a whole year. The fountains of the deep were broken open, rock would have been pulverized, and all that sedimentary mud would have been mixed with the water, and it would have sat for a year.
And since during this time it would have been soft, it would have been subject to the mixing up of various rock grains, creating one big conglomerate layer. And if it did somehow form strata, because they all formed at the same time, we would expect to see the fossils of organisms buried in the sediment to be spanning multiple strata. And yet, with the exception of a type of organism that is known to be able to stand upright for decades to centuries after its death, namely trees, this has never been observed.
Which tells us it would have layered.
Absolutely not. It would have conglomerated into a conglomerate. But since by weight conglomerate only makes up about 1% of all sedimentary rock, this does not indicate a single global flooding event as you're describing it, especially with your description of that the fountains of the deep were pulverizing the rock that they broke through. All that sediment would be a bunch of differently sized gravel, along with lots of fine-grained sediment that would fill in the gaps between the larger gravel class. That's perfect for forming a conglomerate. It's not so good for forming millions of individual and distinct layers.
Just as water does, mixed with mud in a jar.
Well, if you actually take the time to do that jar of variously sized sedimentary grain experiment, then you'll see that it doesn't quite form perfectly distinct layers. It forms a gradient, a gradual transition between the different types of layers. Some of the smaller grain particles will always be found down among the faster settling large grain particles. And for the whole thing to settle, you have to let it sit undisturbed for quite a while. In fact, my son made one of those with chalk dust as one of the types of sediment. And do you know what? The chalk is always on top. Why do I mention this? Because while there are many places on the Earth where chalk is exposed on the surface, if you trace these beds laterally, you find them buried under other types of sedimentary rock that, in our sediments in a jar experiment, would definitely have settled before the chalk. So how did this very light chalk sediment that needs calm waters for extended periods of time in order to settle end up settling below this heavier sediment that would be found in the alluvial deposits?
In 1 year, you would have expected to see this type of layering, and it would be global.
Yes, it would be global, but it is not. Case dismissed.
Fourthly, all those that died, we would find the remains mixed in among those layers.
Mixed in, yes. Not perfectly sorted, mixed. There wouldn't be a complete lack of mammals up until a certain point. You'd be able to find them everywhere. There wouldn't be non-avian dinosaurs constrained to certain specific layers, and specific species of dinosaurs even more constrained than dinosaurs as a whole. You'd expect to find them everywhere. And since they were buried in soft, muddy sediment, as you yourself just said, you'd expect to find them struggling between the layers to try and reach the surface. But that has never, not once, ever been observed.
And lastly, we would expect, because this was such a dramatic event, perhaps the event in human history, aside from the creation itself. So we would expect there to be accounts, stories, in regard to the flood around the world.
Well, since you're qualifying that by pointing out that the creation account would be the bigger story of the two, then wouldn't you also expect a matching creation account to go with the flood story in all these different cultures? But that's not what we get, is it? The only places with a similar creation story are in the ancient Near East, the same area that the Bible was written in. But also, since flooding is a relatively common event, and access to water is one of the top considerations that humans have when deciding where to settle, you would expect stories of floods to pop up everywhere anyway. So if your prediction is identical to a prediction made by just a general observation of how people migrate and decide where to settle, then it's not really that great of a prediction, is it? I can add a couple more predictions to this list as well. If your flood model is correct, you wouldn't find evidence of a culture that is older than 4,000 years. If your model is correct, we shouldn't find any living organism that is older than 4,000 years. Well, we know of several cultures that seem to have not been bothered by the flood, going on existing as per normal right through the period of the flood, in Egypt, China, and the Americas. And there are living organisms that are older than 4,000 years. The Pando Forest is estimated to be at least 14,000 years old, but possibly 80 to 100,000 years old. There's a Norway spruce that has been dated at 9,550 years old. And there have been a few bristlecone pines discovered that are over 4,800 years old. So, yeah, no flood.
And we would also expect to find that the earliest known accounts of these would contain the most facts.
So the Epic of Gilgamesh is more factual than the Bible? Okay, if you say so.
So the earliest record we can find, which should contain the most, or that which would accord closest to the Word of God and to the record we find in the book of Genesis.
Dude, the record you find in the book of Genesis is not the oldest flood myth. That's the Epic of Gilgamesh. If you want to claim that the older ones are more accurate, you are literally denying the accuracy of the biblical account on the grounds that it is not the oldest.
Is there global erosion? Do we see evidence of it?
Yes, because as stated earlier, wind, water, chemicals, and other erosive forces exist all over the globe. As to a singular period of identical erosion that left a global marker, which is what I think you're trying to say, no, no such global marker exists.
Now, I'm not claiming to be a geologist.
Good, so let's just stick with what the geologists actually say then, shall we? Because there are two unconformities that are generally labeled the Great Unconformity. One is in Scotland, the other is found throughout most of North America. The one in Scotland has basement rocks that are about 425 million years old, while the one in North America has basement rocks that are anywhere from 740 million years old to 1.8 billion years old, depending on where we look. Whatever other conclusions you may be able to draw from this, one thing is certain. The Earth be old. Now, I'm skipping a few minutes of his talk. Apparently, I overestimated his prowess as a creationist, thinking that he was going to bring up the Great Unconformity as evidence of global erosion in the past, but no, he literally just lists a bunch of canyons all over the world and says, "See? They got eroded!" And now, of course, he ends with the Grand Canyon in Arizona, the creationist favorite. I wonder if any creationist will ever bring up the Yarlung Tsangpo Canyon of Tibet. Because, as impressive as the Grand Canyon is, the Yarlung Tsangpo Canyon is actually the deepest canyon in the world, and while it is not the longest in the world, it is slightly longer than the Grand Canyon.
It is the most spectacular evidence that we have for erosion. If you've never seen erosion and what erosion looks like, you need to go to the Grand Canyon.
I'm starting to wonder if this dude doesn't think that erosion happens at all except as a result of Noah's flood.
And if there were ever a case for erosion on a massive scale, the Grand Canyon is it. But we don't find it, as you've noticed, just on one continent. I've shown it on Europe, I've shown it in South America. There are examples of this in Asia, all over the world.
Yes, you find canyons on every continent. Everywhere that water exists, you find rivers. And wherever rivers exist, you find canyons. Funny how that works. Of course, the real question here is, why do we have canyons at all? As I mentioned, a more skilled creationist might go to the Great Unconformity as evidence of global erosion, which then leaves us asking, if the whole world were covered with water, and this water swept over the whole world so violently as to essentially flatten it and cause the unconformities, then would the deposition above them not be relatively uniform? Meaning that there shouldn't be mountain ranges and canyons and such. The Earth should be significantly smoother than it is, with only those features that could have formed in a few thousand years since the flood. Also, just as a point of order, there are canyons on Mars, too. This guy seems to think that a global flood is the only thing that could cause all these canyons. Does that mean the global flood stretched all the way out to Mars as well?
It causes you to think about what could have caused such massive, catastrophic erosion.
And you can find the answer to that question in many a grade school science textbook. Mostly it's the rivers at the bottoms of these canyons, but there are other factors involved as well. You could learn about them by, you know, reading a book or something, instead of just looking at pretty pictures. I literally had to skip about 6 minutes of his video as he just showed pictures of various canyons around the world and said, "Wow, so big, so pretty, much flood."
So we see evidence. Strong evidence of global erosion. But what about global cracking of the crust?
Now's when I would normally assume that he's talking about the continental rifts, but for the last point, I assumed he would be talking about the Great Unconformity, when instead it was just an argument from, "Wow, them canyons is big!" So I'm not going to make any assumptions here.
This is a picture of what is known as the Mid-Atlantic Ridge.
Oh good, he got this one right! Okay, but I'm gonna go ahead and skip this section anyway, because I think I covered the rift argument adequately earlier by simply pointing out that the creationist calculations of the amount of energy released for the continents to have moved in the way that creationist models predict during the flood would have turned the entire Earth into a molten ball for millions of years without an appeal to magic.
So, what about layering on a global scale?
Yeah, what about it? You'd expect that if all the strata were formed in the same event, and that event were global, then all of the strata would be global as well, with just a handful of minor irregularities. But that's not what you see at all. What you really see is a bunch of clearly local layers that were formed in very localized environments which wouldn't have been possible in a worldwide flood.
Now, I could literally show you hundreds of pictures, but I selected a few from all over.
Oh, God, is this one going to be just another, hey, look, the laws of physics work the same in all the places on the Earth, therefore my physics-breaking event must be true. It can't possibly be that deposition is just a natural physical process.
Just what you would expect, where the Earth has been ground and pulverized by water, and then let to settle for a whole year.
No, what you would expect in that case is one really big, somewhat sorted conglomerate layer, which would form a gradient with the larger, heavier grains mostly found at the bottom, and the finer grain sediments that would have floated around in the water longer on top. But that isn't even close to what we see.
This is what you would expect to find. So, what about global fossils?
Given the Earth's long history, you would expect to find many fossils in many local environments pretty much everywhere on the Earth. Now, if everything were wiped out in one single global flooding event, and through some miraculous alteration of the laws of physics we ended up with the distinct strata that we have, we would then expect to see the animals that were buried in all the sediment to be frequently found poking through two or more layers. That is not what we see.
There was a lot of plant and animal life that died in that cataclysm.
Yeah, actually. Along those lines, with the amount of fossil material we have found, combined with the amount of rock material that is made up of the remains of living organisms, like organic limestones, there had to have been so many animals alive at all the same time during the flood as to be basically physically impossible.
But you have literally trees buried alive. Buried in these layers.
Yeah. Upright fossil trees, the explanation for which has been well understood since the late 1800s. Call me when you have an animal going through multiple layers.
And it's hard for me to imagine how a tree can last a billion years to be buried.
Well, maybe it'll help you imagine it better if you actually look into it a little bit more than you have and find that the trees are always buried in sediments that are of the quick-forming variety. But then I suppose that would shatter the creationist talking point about how mainstream geologists insist that rock layers take millions of years to form, which just isn't the case at all, but creationists can't admit that because then they lose at least half of their geology-based arguments.
So what about our last prediction? We've seen everything so far.
Have we seen everything so far? Okay. Maybe we have, but I would argue that your predictions are wrong in the first place, so the everything that we have seen doesn't actually point to a flood. But really, to know for sure, you'd have to get a lot more specific. Like, we'd expect to see erosion. Yeah, whether there was a global flood or not, just by virtue of the fact that stuff exists, we would expect to see erosion. The problem is, we would not expect to see the erosional patterns that we do see, with erosion happening locally depending on local environmental conditions. We would expect to see one giant erosional event followed by more localized events afterward. The Earth's crust being cracked is a weird one. We see the fault lines as a result of tectonic activity, sure, but we don't see evidence that there was once a great supply of water being stored under there. In reading through the story, this actually seems to support the idea that the ancient Hebrews had a cosmology that was similar to the other ancient Near East cultures of the time, that being that the Earth is a flat surface that is held up out of the waters of the deep on pillars and kept dry from the waters of heaven with a firmament. If we go back to the creation story, God separated the waters above from the waters below with the firmament. In the flood story, he opens the fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven, thereby allowing the waters below and the waters above to flow in and flood out the earth. Given that we know how the rifts behave today, and we know that in order for them to have behaved as the creationist needs them to, the earth would have heated up into a molten ball, I'm going to go ahead and say this one's a win for conventional geology. Global sedimentary layering is something that we do not see. Now sure, we do see layers of sediment all across the globe, but only rarely are any of the individual layers truly global. That would be the rule rather than the exception if they were all deposited in the same flood event. And while we do see fossils globally, we would expect that if they all died in the same event, they wouldn't be perfectly sorted like they are. You don't find humans and non-avian dinosaurs together. You don't find Cambrian mammals. You don't find angiosperms in the Devonian. Creationists like to propose some sort of hydrologic sorting mechanism where the more dense, heavier animals are buried lower, while the less dense ones are buried higher, with intelligence being a factor that can contribute to a larger, denser animal being found in higher layers, as a more intelligent animal apparently knows how to run away from a flood more than a less intelligent animal, as if that is some sort of intellectual challenge. but neither intelligence nor hydrologic sorting are enough to account for the order in which we find the fossils. No matter how intelligent you are, if you live in a big flat plain, a sudden flood is not going to stop and give you time to make a potentially weeks-long journey to higher ground so that it can bury you after it buries your pet aqualops, which you callously left behind to die in the encroaching flood. Any flood that moved slowly enough to allow this sort of travel would have allowed it for everything that was trying not to drown, and anything that was sudden enough to not allow this sort of travel would have buried everything together. And also there's the fact that plants are sorted pretty neatly like this as well, and they don't exactly run away when a flood comes after them.
But what about global flood stories? Do we have evidence? Do we have a written record or oral records of a flood?
Well, given how prevalent flooding is all over the Earth, you would expect to find all sorts of written and oral accounts of various floods regardless. And that is what you do find.
So that's the summary. Now I want to show you a little chart. This is taken out of a book. It's called The Deluge Story in Stone. But in that book, there's a little chart regarding the flood story as found in the book of Genesis, chapter 7. And 8.
I'm going to save you most of his rambling about this chart, but I would just like to point out that the only item on the chart that every single flood myth is actually in agreement with is the destruction by water category. And that's like, duh, it's a flood legend. If it wasn't destruction by water, it wouldn't be a flood. The second most agreed upon aspect is that humans are saved. Seems to me like if humans still existed to tell the story, they would want to explain how humans survived the flood legend to explain how the audience could even be there to listen to the story. Ark provided is another commonly shared aspect, and again, how did the humans survive? Well, boats float, maybe it was on a boat. Seems like that would be an expected answer, but aside from these three categories, there doesn't seem to be any significant agreement on the details of the story. Animals only get saved in 8 out of the 41 legends on the chart. That seems like an important detail to omit. Only in 11 of the legends do they qualify for the divine destruction category, meaning that there are 30 where the flood is natural in origin. We're missing the idea of a favored family in more than half of them. Only 14 of them say the flood is because of humanity's transgressions. I don't know, I feel like this chart is pointing out how incredibly different all these flood stories are from the story of Noah.
And the most impressive, the most ancient, as I mentioned, the Babylonian-Assyrian record. It's found in the Epic of Gilgamesh. And in that epic, it contains all the details, different names, different location, but the same event with the same details.
And since your argument earlier was that the oldest record will be the most accurate, that makes the Epic of Gilgamesh the most accurate of the flood legends, since it is older than the one found in the Bible by about 500 years.
And what is intriguing about it is that, according to secular historians, the first record of it was most likely written between 2100 and 1900 BC. Now that's old. That's around the time of Abraham and just before him. So that gives you an idea of just how ancient that Babylonian record is. Now, we know that around the time of Abraham, these things were still very clear in their minds. For Moses came some 400 years later, and he wrote the account.
So there you go. By your own admission, the oldest account of the historical flood was one written some 400 years before the biblical account was written. And you argued earlier that the oldest one would be the most accurate. So either the Epic of Gilgamesh tells the true account of the flood, with the Bible account being a derivative work, or there's no reason to accept the flood legends as all actually being true. And that's basically it for this one. He never actually explains how the Gilgamesh legend being earlier than the biblical legend fits into his narrative about the older legends being more accurate. He just transitions into his conclusion. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Sublime Sparrow, who says, "The amount of appeals to no true Christian almost makes me wonder if there are any." No, I can say for sure that there are no true Christians, by virtue of the fact that there are multiple Christian sects that would argue that anyone who is not a member of their specific sect cannot be a true Christian. Therefore, Christianity doesn't exist, or something. Thanks for watching. Special thanks as always to my patrons, Lynn Dobbs, Mark McMahon, Is What Jesus, and all the rest, who are the erosion that carved the canyon that is my channel. If you'd like to exist just by virtue of the fact that stuff exists, you can join us on Patreon for as little as $1 per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist, which are linked in the description. If you'd like to listen to my videos in podcast form, the link for that is also in the description, as well as links to my social media accounts and my P.O. Box address. See you next time. Time.